October 22 is a very significant day in the history of our beginnings.
Hello, my friends. Welcome back to the Adventist History Podcast. This is part 3 of our series on Desmond Ford. Last time, we followed Desmond Ford back to school, first at Avondale for a bachelor's degree, then to the Adventist Seminary in Tacoma Park, finally to Michigan State University for his first doctorate. Dr. Ford returned to Avondale in 1961, just in time to deal with his theological sparring partner, Robert Brinsmead. Desmond Ford took up his new position as head of the Bible department or the theological department at Avondale in 1961, as I mentioned, after the church had arranged for him to get, and I think this is worth repeating, basically 3 degrees in 4 years. Now, when he returned, it was expected that he would repay the church by defending her, especially, of course, from Robert Brinsmead. Brinsmead, as I've noticed in previous episodes, was teaching this. It's really hard to characterize his theology because you want to say it's like this. You know, we resort to these categories. It's last generation theology, or it's liberalism, or it's whatever. You know, we have these categories to help you situate where somebody's belief system puts them, because we believe a lot of things. Our belief systems are complex. And so we look for these shorthand ways of saying, like, okay, what camp, what tribe is he a part of? And Brinsmead really defies all efforts to situate him in a tribe. He's always been his own person. And so, anyways, but it was a deeply perfectionistic version of Adventism, but probably not in the way that you're thinking. Brinsmead was worried about perfectionism that happens at the very end, and less concerned. He wasn't optimistic that we were going to be perfect before the end. And so it wasn't like we need to keep perfecting ourselves until the end. It was more of like, no, when the latter end comes, then we'll be perfect. Anyways, not trying to get into all of Brinsmead's theology here. Just wanted to kind of remind you where he's at. Anyways, Jack Castle, who later became president of Pacific Union College, we'll meet him again. He characterized Brinsmead's message as, quote, complete acceptance of Ellen White as superior to Scripture and verbally inspired, end quote, as well as saying that Brinsmead's position was one of extreme fundamentalism, in his words. Like I said, there's a sense in which these labels don't quite fit, but I do think they serve to give you the gist of where Brinsmead was at. In some ways, he was far more conservative than even the conservatives. And in some ways, he was not. He had his own position in the spectrum of Adventist theology. And I've talked about him in other episodes. Well, anyways, shortly after returning to Avondale, Des was invited to speak at the University of Sydney on a Friday evening for the 80 or so Adventist college students who attended there. Des was asked to speak about the value of Ellen White for the church, which is a, you know, good conversation to have on a public school campus. In the course of his talk, Des noted that Ellen White could be wrong on things. Ellen White had said, along with many other Christians in her day, that Paul wrote Hebrews, for instance. Des didn't believe Paul wrote Hebrews. Des replied that modern scholarship no longer believes that either. Ellen White had said the earth was 6,000 years old. Des said the earth was closer to 10,000 years old. The president of the Adventist student group was stunned. So was his twin brother. They would later recall Des's presentation as, quote, a direct challenge to the inspiration of the words of the Spirit of Prophecy, end quote. Now, as far as I know, we only have Colin and Russell Standish's account of what Des said, published at that time in their SDA Student Society Bulletin. If Des was highlighting the human side of Ellen White, it was to combat the St. Ellen that Bob Brinsmead was upholding. Likewise, Des's 1962 book, Unlocking God's Treasury, set forth Des's ideas on perfection, sanctification, and righteousness by faith. Again, not to target the faith of the Standish brothers, but to respond to what Robert Brinsme was teaching. That seldom ever did that explicitly. He didn't say, here's what he's saying, here's what I'm saying. It was more of, let me just present to you the other side of the coin, and I don't have to mention Brinsmead's name. Dez understood his mandate upon returning to Avondale when he said, quote, my main overt problem at Avondale in 1961 was counteracting legalism, end quote. A number of Dez's students from the 1960s found his teaching on the gospel and perfection to be a breath of fresh air. I talked with one of them, and he had tears in his eyes, even 60 years later. Others felt like they understood the gospel for the first time. This is the foundation, and it's critical that we understand this. It's the foundation for many people's intense loyalty to Dez in the years to come. One of them would later write to Dez and say, I was on my way out of Adventism, but I stay in Adventism because of the gospel that you and, as we'll get to later on, Robert Brinsmead were teaching in the 1970s. Dez was the reason for hanging on, not because of his personality or whatnot, but just because of the way he believed the gospel and the way he taught the gospel. That was their reason for this intense loyalty that transcended, in many cases, transcended this loyalty to this thing we call Adventism. It was to Dez and to his message about Jesus. That's what stirred people. And I suppose, not having lived through that era of Adventist history myself, maybe some of you have, maybe you can better understand what Adventism was like at the time where Dez's message about the gospel felt like a breath of fresh air, where it felt like this is a new and beautiful and wonderful thing happened, and he's my ride or die. I'll be with Dez until the end. And so anyways, as we go on, we're going to get to Glacier View. We're going to get to the reactions of Glacier View in future episodes. And I think if you don't understand the climate of Adventism in the day, and what his message meant to some people, to many people, I think it's really difficult to understand, why are people so attached to him? Why are people still fighting this battle 40 years later? And there's not a whole lot of them today, but there are some who are still fighting this battle. It's important to understand that, because if you're a part of my generation or a younger generation, you didn't grow up with Dez Ford. You didn't grow up with Glacier View. That was a thing your parents had to deal with, or a thing your grandparents had to deal with. And I don't understand what all the fuss is about. So anyways, it's worth keeping this in mind as we go. Why were people so attached to him? It was in large part because of the gospel that he preached and the way that he preached it and what that meant in the context of Adventism at that day, which was definitely more performance-focused, more authoritative, in the way that it approached certain lifestyle practices. I was reading David Trim's good book on Walter Utt, who was a PUC history teacher. And, Utt weighs in on one of the controversies in the 70s at PUC, and not just at PUC, but other campuses too. You know, are men allowed to have beards? It was a thing, right? If you have this beard, I don't know what, are you a hippie or something? There was a strong reaction that the upstanding Adventist youth should not wear a beard. You know, we hear that today and we think, what on earth are we concerned about? What's the big fuss? I just want you to put yourself on a campus in those days when there's a serious argument over beards or what music you listen to and how you dress. And there are very strict standards about these things. And here comes Dez, or somebody like him. Dez was not the only one who is more evangelical in their Adventism, more gospel-focused in their Adventism, and that undoubtedly felt like a breath of fresh air to many people. To other people, it felt like he was refusing to defend the old standards, and therefore he would be a threat to the church. Well, anyways, like I said, a number of the students, though, found it to be a breath of fresh air. Others would later recall that it's like they heard the gospel for the first time with Dez. He was to them the one who opened their eyes to the love of God. One student from his class in 1965 reflected, quote, "I never had a teacher like him, and no other at Avondale could match his standard. He never used notes, and when checking his work, he was always spot on. He was amazing. Those memories will last for eternity," end quote. Even Gerhard Fandel, by no means a Ford follower, could admit that Ford, quote, "was a charismatic preacher with a phenomenal memory. I spent many hours in his classroom and still consider him one of the best teachers I've ever had," end quote. And it was said throughout the 1960s that none of Dez's students ever went over to Brinsmead. And that was a huge, huge commendation for him, because this is what church leaders were anxious about in the 1960s, in both in Australia and in America, about people going over to Brinsmead's specific brand of perfectionism and almost a kind of a cult following for Brinsmead. And Dez managed to protect Avondale, which meant that he was protecting the students who would go on to be ministers and evangelists and whatnot. He was protecting the one pipeline in the Australasian division that was producing the next round of pastors and evangelists and church leaders and so forth. And so it was critical that Avondale be protected from Brinsmead's influence, and Dez did that. So it was natural that Dez's reputation would grow, that church leaders would appreciate him and honor him, and those who wanted to criticize him, like some of the parents of the students who felt Dez was abandoning the standards, like George Burnside, who had briefly butted heads with Dez back in 1951 when Dez first graduated from Avondale and was sent to work with Burnside for a few months to assist him in his evangelistic series. Burnside now was the ministerial secretary for the division, so no small fish. Burnside began to openly wonder if students at Avondale were being led astray. Some of these concerned people banded together to get Ford fired. But Ford had other friends in the division office, as well as the president of the college, who valued him and what he was doing. Ford's critics in the 1960s were perceptive, I think, in seeing where all this might lead. Conservatives joined more evangelical or progressive Adventists in opposing Brinsmead's positions, but that didn't quite make them allies. When Edward Heppenstall came out and said in 1963 that, quote, "absolute perfection and sinlessness cannot be realized here and now," end quote, conservatives rightly realized that such a statement was not just aimed at ultra-conservatives or whatever you want to call Brinsmead, but against all conservatives, against all traditional Adventists who believed in some form of perfectionism. As Lockhart and Bull note in their book, Heppenstall's statement was far more radical than what Brinsmead was teaching. But so long as Brinsmead was seen as enemy number one, the church would take all of the firepower they could get. To use an obviously extreme example, okay? It was like the communist Chinese and the nationalist Chinese fighting together against the Japanese in World War II. Right now, they had a common enemy, but that didn't exactly make them allies. That didn't necessarily mean that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. No, sometimes the enemy of my enemy is still my enemy. We're just choosing not to shoot at each other right now. At times, Ford did seem to be the nearer enemy, especially as Brinsmead spent much of his time in America. Some of the old guard in Australia, of course including George Burnside, began openly fulminating against Avondale. Someone in the college community circulated a letter to arrest the apostasy at the college. The letter included a disdainful reference to a TV antenna that happened to appear at an administrator's house. You didn't want to be the first Adventist in a community to get a TV, okay? You got to wait for the coast to be clear, especially if you're a leader at the college. You didn't want to be first. Anyways, another evangelist pointed north in the direction of Avondale at one point and declared, "The King of the North is up there," which is a Daniel 11 reference and not a positive one. When Burnside was near Avondale at one point, he remarked that, quote, "heresy is being taught at an institution not far from here," end quote. Well, that one crossed the line, and Burnside and Dez and others were brought in the room to understand exactly what Burnside was insinuating right there. And Burnside said, no, I wasn't aiming that at Avondale at all. I wonder where he really was. Where he was aiming that, because, I mean, how many Adventist institutions were around there? But anyways, he backed off of that one in a hurry. But people who were in the know knew what he was hinting at, right? Dez still had an ally in Lawrence Naden, the radio pastor who was partly responsible for Dez becoming an Adventist in the first place. He was then secretary of the Australasian Division, still head of its radio and TV work. Naden shrugged Burnside off and supported Dez in that instance. The two continued to have conversations about how best to combat Bob Brinsmead's influence. Nevertheless, Ford insisted through this all, no matter how much he disagreed with Brinsmead, he would say some version of this statement, quote, "I found Bob an excellent man to differ with," end quote. Despite Ford's efforts as a bulwark against his frenemy, Brinsmead, personal tragedy struck at home. Dez's wife, Gwen, found a lump in her breast one day. She was 33 years old. Surgeries followed, so did natural remedies. The cancer went away. Gwen managed to give birth to the couple's third and final child, another son, but then cancer again. Bone cancer. This time, there was nothing anyone could do. Dez had the difficult task of telling his wife that, short of a miracle, she was going to die. And he broke the news somehow through a Bible study, which she later said helped her to accept the news. It wasn't just, "Hey, honey, got the doctor's report. You're not going to make it." But he started going through some Bible passages and then somehow let the truth leak out in that context so that I guess she was at least spiritually ready to accept it. Meanwhile, 1966, Dez had a new student, Jillian Wastel. Dez gave her an A for an essay she wrote on Last Day Events. Jillian approved her typing, ended up working for Dez as his secretary after Dez's previous secretary had recommended her. Gwen needed more care than Dez could provide, and Verna Brinsmead, Bob's sister-in-law, the Brinsmead family is a big family, okay, agreed to take care of her. Jillian also came around to help pushing Gwen in a wheelchair as Dez walked alongside them. With his wife on her deathbed now, Dez was determined never to marry again. Perfectly understandable, right? Lots of people would say that in that same position. But two church leaders visiting Dez diplomatically, I mean, you'd have to be diplomatically, right? How do you show up and say, "How are you feeling? How are things going? By the way, you should remarry again, you know, even while your wife is still alive." Not that he should remarry while his wife is still alive, but they're telling him this while his wife is still alive. Dez was not enthused by this. He was burning out. He had told the church that he needed a break. And by break, by the way, he meant he wanted a second doctorate in England. And we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. Dez begrudgingly agreed, however, that he should remarry for his sake, for the kids' sake, but only after he returned from England, right? Let me go get my degree first, then I can sit down and think about this question of remarriage. But the two church leaders said, 2 years? That's too long to wait. You need to get married before you go. Now, if it sounds painful for Dez and a couple of other men to be talking about remarriage when his wife is still alive, let me just tell you two things, and hopefully this helps this make a little bit more sense for you. First, there were pragmatic reasons why the church strongly encouraged ministers to be married. Who would raise your three children while you worked and traveled for the church? I mean, Dez's job was all-consuming. You know, to stop and raise your kids, it means you're not going to many camp meetings to preach. You might have to lighten your teaching at the university. I mean, it had grave implications for his work and his career. And I know that doesn't seem like that's the biggest concern in that moment, right? But it was certainly something he took seriously as well, right? Like, is he equipped to do this? And again, it was just a different age in terms of how men and women raise kids. The second thing that's worth keeping in mind is that Dez and Gwen had an understanding in place more than a year before she died. Gwen wanted Dez to get to know Jillian better and, you know, see where that goes. And just in case, though, Gwen gave Dez a list of women he could pursue after her death, which, you might feel differently about that. I think it's very cute. This was, I believe, her way of making sure her husband and her kids were taken care of. It was a selfless, maternal thing to do, if you ask me. Jillian is certainly listening to this episode, so I'm not going to say too much more. I will note how well Jillian suited Dez for this next phase of his life. Jillian was more willing to fight alongside her husband in the theological skirmishes to come. And Dez's mother realized this too, warning her son, or perhaps reassuring her son, that Jillian was, quote, not the same as Gwen, end quote. Thank you, Mom, for that just very helpful insight. Jillian took this to mean that she was tougher, and however Dez's mom meant that statement, it must be a compliment. Some would later whisper that Glacier View never would have happened if Gwen were still alive. Now, that's a really unfair thing to say, especially to Jillian. It's rather typical to blame the man's wife for his misfortune or his controversy or whatever it is that you don't like about him. But it is true that Jillian was not going to sit on the back bench and watch. In any case, Gwen passed to her rest in April 1970. An article she had written before her death was published posthumously in the Australasian Record, chronicled her experience with cancer and her experience with God. She bravely asked the question she must have known others might ask, has God forsaken me? Or you might say, why would God let this happen to her? She answered, quote, when my death comes, it will not be a tragedy, a cutting off, an untimely event, but a full fruition of the Lord's plan for my life, end quote. The article is hard to read, but in a good way. Gwen ended with gratitude, quote, I feel very awed, grateful, and rich when I consider what the Lord has done for me, end quote. Now, after trying to avoid crying while I read this letter, I have the unenviable task in this episode of moving on to explain how Dez decided to go forward with Jillian. Such an abrupt turn in our tale risks making everyone seem like monsters in a rush to forget Gwen. But that's just, chalk that up to my poor storytelling and not to anyone's motives in this story. You must remember that Gwen's death was a long time coming and people had a lot of time to make peace with it, to say goodbyes, and to think about the future, and that it was Gwen's wish that Dez would pursue Jillian for his sake and for the kid's sake. Milton Hook includes a letter Robert Parr wrote Dez about Jillian, and you may remember my own opinion about Robert Parr as my favorite letter writer in Avenus history. His letters never, ever fail to amuse you. Robert Parr was an editor, and he approved of Jillian, but he had some words of caution for Dez. Quote, one thing I beg of you, please do not court the lady by correspondence. Never write her a letter, in your own hand, that is. She will go absolutely bonkers trying to decipher it. And when you next see her, she will be a gibbering frustrate, a wild-eyed paranoiac who went off her rocker trying to make sense out of that spidery scrawl that you euphemistically refer to in your light moments as writing. If there must be correspondence, please use a typewriter, end quote. Chef's kiss, buddy. Good stuff. Jillian and Desmond wed 7 months after Gwen's death on November 22nd, 1970. David Sibley, the conference president who had first hired Dez out of Avondale, officiated. Jillian says she didn't realize Dez had planned to go to England to study until a month before their marriage, but that's what they did. In early December, Jillian graduated, age 26, and the new couple were off to England. Now, why did Dez want to go to England so badly for a second doctorate? A possibility emerges. from a letter Dez wrote to the man who would be his Dr. Vater, the famed scholar F.F. Bruce. Dez wrote Bruce weeks before Jillian would pass, admitting that, quote, despite my two earlier degrees in theology, my deficiencies in that discipline are many, end quote. Okay. So it seems that Dez realized that there was some kind of gap in his theological education that he wanted to plug, and that this degree would do that. In the same letter, Dez is clearly aware that asking Avondale for another leave is, well, a big ask. Avondale was short-staffed, and the board would be unwilling to let him go unless, as he put it, quote, I can give some assurance that I will be back in what will seem a reasonable time. Dez strategized that since Avondale wanted to eventually offer an MA program, it would be worthwhile for a member of their faculty to have a doctorate from a more prestigious school than Michigan State. No offense, Sparty. Go Buckeyes. Specifically, of course, in an English university, as Australia had plenty of American-trained PhDs. Dez also asked Bruce if he planned to remain at Manchester because, quote, my denomination has had some unfortunate experiences with some men sent to universities for further study. A few of them have gone forth as evangelicals and returned as liberals, end quote. Dez planned to tell Avondale that it would strengthen the school if he went. They would get a stronger MA program out of it. And he hoped to tell the college that Bruce, a widely respected scholar, would, of course, remain as his advisor for the duration of his study. And that's the point of asking whether Bruce would remain at Manchester. I don't want to get there and then find out somebody else who, I don't know, some liberal professor shows up and takes your place and completes my training there, and then I'm going to get myself in trouble. Avondale voted in September 1970, 2 months before his marriage to Jillian, to approve Dez's study leave for the University of Manchester. Another reason emerged for going in a letter Dez sent to Keith Parmenter in 1978. Parmenter would be the president of the division at that time, and we're going to hear a whole lot more about him by the end. Dez writes, quote, my specific reason in going to England was to find support for answers I was giving to critics of our sanctuary teachings, end quote. So here Dez adds another angle as to why he's going to England. He's looking for answers. He's defending the church, but he feels like maybe he's running out of ammunition. He needs to get some answers to some questions that have emerged while he was defending the church. But the major reason why Dez wanted to go to England was that he was burned out. Quote, I told the college that they could either send me to England or I would have to resign, end quote. An ultimatum. What was the source of Dez's burnout? Was it his frantic schedule, the death of his wife, his nagging questions about the sanctuary, or a combination of all of these? Evidently, Dez was so valuable that the college would rather send him halfway around the world for 2 years to get a second doctorate than risk losing him. But it wasn't just the college that needed persuading to let Dez go. Dez also needed to persuade F.F. Bruce to accept him. Realizing that Bruce might harbor the usual prejudices against Adventists, some of those prejudices have been earned, by the way, Ford affirmed that, quote, I am a member of the Seventh-day Adventist denomination without necessarily endorsing all of the views publicly set forth by Sabbatarians, end quote. Now, that's a curious statement, to say the least. Now, look, every Adventist probably differs from other Adventists on at least something. But Dez doesn't spell out exactly where he differs. In light of Glacier View, most of us might look back at that statement and assume that he meant that he differs on topics like the investigative judgment. The fact that Dez doesn't explain what he means suggests to me, at least, that he's just covering his bases in hopes that Bruce will give him the benefit of the doubt. That is, if F.F. Bruce happens to think poorly of Adventists for some reason or the other, Dez's disclaimer that, hey, I don't necessarily believe everything that Adventists believe, would offer hope that maybe this Dez character isn't necessarily in agreement with whatever Bruce objects to. You might have to play that back about 5 times to make sense of that. That's one of those things that it's easier to read and understand than it is to hear and understand. Anyways, F.F. Bruce did want Dez, and it was hard going at first. The first 3 months of his research was all in German. Dez didn't know German. Fortunately, Jill knew German. She was a German and French major. And fortunately, they also had a German neighbor. Jill ended up translating hundreds of pages of German and French books for Dez to work with, saving him, as he later claimed, 2 years worth of work on his own. Dez's topic was on the role of the abomination of desolation in biblical eschatology, and he repackaged some of Ellen White's insights to make an original contribution to his field. As Dez settled into his work in England, Brinsmead had his great about face, and we've talked about that in other episodes, switching from his peculiar perfectionism to a more evangelical flavor of Adventism. Dez was summoned to Washington, D.C. for some meetings with the Brethren and the Brinsmead brothers, both Bob and John. And Dez used the opportunity, this is really where his heart was at this point, to do some research at the Library of Congress. Dez was given 2 years to write this dissertation. He did it in 18 months, as usual. That's what he did at seminary. That's what he did at Michigan State. And that's what he did at Manchester. 18 months each time. Several theological features of Dez's Glacier View manuscript came out during his time in England, such as his belief that Jesus could have returned in the first century, as well as his idea that Jesus' final week, his Passion Week, contains the key to understanding Daniel and Revelation. Finishing in record time yet again, F.F. Bruce told Dez to take a break. So Dez bought a car for £44, and he and his family drove through Europe. Now this I really want to understand. How do you buy a car for £44? That's like $52 US right now. I don't know what the exchange rate was back then. But what car are you buying for £44? What does it look like? Does anyone have a picture of this car? Goodness gracious. Anyways, when they got back, Dez did his oral defense. He succeeded, returned home to Australia. All right, so now he's back in Australia, 1972, chair of the religion department at Avondale once again. The anti-Dez faction that began stirring in the 1960s, however, was stronger in the 1970s. And it seems that there's reasons for why this is, but it seems significant that Brinsmead's flip from being this peculiar perfectionist to adopting what basically a kind of evangelical Protestant take on righteousness by faith, on the gospel, and that position ended up being very close to Ford's own position. And so they had fewer things to disagree about, which meant that it looked as if Ford and Brinsmead were on the same side. Accusations that Ford and Brinsmead were false foes during the 1960s, you know, like they really weren't against each other. They were really colluding the whole time. You know, this conspiracy theory. It began to seem more credible, right? Robert Brinsmead's niece and another follower were enrolled at Avondale in Dez's absence and began circulating Brinsmead's sermons. Meanwhile, someone contacted F.F. Bruce in Manchester to ask whether Dez Ford was a futurist, which is a school of prophetic interpretation at odds with Adventism's historicist approach. Bruce denied that either he or Dez were futurists. But you get what this means, right? You remember when we had our Adventist Evangelical conferences and questions on doctrine came out, and A.L. Hudson out in Oregon contacted Donald Gray Barnhouse. He's like, hey, what really happened at these meetings? You know, have our people given up the truth? You know, that we talked about that conversation. That was fantastic. But the similar thing happening here. Let's contact F.F. Bruce and find out the truth. What does Dez Ford really believe? Is he really a futurist? Naturally, this group was also annoyed that Dez was given permission and funding to attain a second doctorate when a number of pastors had to fund their own doctoral work. Okay, there was not enough church funds. There were not enough study leaves to grant so that everybody who wanted a doctorate could have one. And here is Dez Ford with two doctorates in about 10 years. Colin Standish wrote to Dez in 1973 in June to take issue once again with Dez's claim that the earth was older than 6,000 years old. And Let me just say, Des's claim, as he gave at the University of Sydney about 10 years before, was that it's about 10,000 years old. And again, just try to put yourself into their shoes, because today the claim that the Earth is about 10,000 years old is really just functionally similar to saying that it's 6,000 years old. I mean, we're talking about 4,000 years at a time when most people think it is billions of years old. We're not talking about a huge difference here. And so to us, it's like, why are they fighting over 4,000 years, right? When I mean, they're both very, in the scale of geologic time that we're talking about here, it might as well be like a, one day versus the next day. But anyways, so it seems kind of a weird thing to be worked up about today, but back then it had significance purely because, or largely because, Ellen White mentioned the phrase 6,000 years, that Earth was about 6,000 years old, many, many times. So it's not so much about how old the Earth is per se, it is about whether or not we believe Ellen White, okay? Des went through the sources. He talks about the SDA Bible Commentary. Talks about Siegfried Horn and his studies. So he's appealing to these other Adventist sources, saying, this is where I get my 10,000 years from. And he's explaining this to Colin Standish before concluding, quote, I am fearful lest we cut off the ears of educated people by insisting on something which they knew to be false. Such a blunder could lead them to believe that our beliefs were similarly erroneous. You need have no fear as to how the writings of the Spirit of Prophecy are used at Avondale, end quote. Now, what Des is saying there, of course, is reasonable. We got to be careful of what stands we take. If we take too strong of an irrational stand on an issue, and people can just easily look up the truth and they realize we're wrong. And if you're wrong about that, you must be wrong about Sabbath. You must be wrong about the other things you interpret from the Bible. But we might say today, well, that's a slippery slope, right? Because even 10,000 years seems ridiculous today. And if we insist on 10,000 years, it is, as he put it in that memorable phrase, cutting off the ears of educated people by insisting on something which they know to be false. And so, anyways, I don't know that in principle anyone's going to disagree with his argument there, but when do you stop, right? Is our truth based on what educated people know to be true? Okay. Can we ever contradict educated people? Can they ever be wrong? So anyways, that's a conversation I'd love to have, and unfortunately I can't have that with him, but that's his response to Colin Standish back in 1973. So, we're having this discussion. Age of the Earth is one of these things that just annoys these people about Des Ford. They see it as a kind of a creeping liberalism that he represents. It's not so blatant as like, oh yeah, I believe in evolution. It's just, it opens the door just a little crack when we move from 6,000 years to 10,000 years. We're moving away from what Ellen White clearly said the age of the Earth is. Now, this grumbling did very little damage at first. Bob Parr at Signs of the Times managed to persuade Des to put some of his research to use to publish a chapter-by-chapter commentary on Daniel. Signs of the Times called it, quote, the most important series ever to appear in this journal, end quote. The series was called Ford on Daniel, and Signs really, really gave it the full treatment. Hyped it up, as you can tell, calling it the most important series we've ever published. I mean, goodness, if that doesn't get your readers' attention, I don't know what does. So they hyped it up. And then they kind of gave Ford's articles its own look in the magazine. When you turned to a page that was Ford on Daniel as part of that series, you knew what series you were in. Just the visual cues, the green colors and the design elements and the charts and photographs and all those sorts of things they threw in there visually distinguished it from the rest of the magazine. Now, even before Des had met F.F. Bruce, Des had come to accept that Daniel 8:14 shouldn't be translated, after 2,300 evenings and mornings, the sanctuary shall be cleansed. This is a King James translation. Dez preferred vindicated, as did many Bible scholars at the time. But the fact that Dez mentions this in his own way, in his articles, is an indication of where he's trying to gently nudge the reader away from cleansed towards vindicated. In these articles, Dez also mentions that the 2300 years end in 1844. Pretty standard stuff. But that 1844's significance is as, quote, the year that religiously, scientifically, politically, and sociologically marks the beginning of modern times, end quote. Or we might say the beginning of end times. Dez also defends the day for year principle, which states that in apocalyptic prophecy, a day often represents a year. So in Daniel 8:14, the 2300 evenings and mornings, the evenings and mornings are taken to mean a day, just like in the creation week. Those are not really 2300 days, they're 2300 years. Quote, such a measure is required, end quote, Dez is writing here. Anyways, back to the quote. Quote, if indeed the prophecy of the 2300 days was to extend from the time of Daniel to the commencement of the time of the end, end quote. In other words, Dez is not really demonstrating the validity of the year-for-day principle through any kind of special arguments. He's basically saying, look, if this prophecy of 2300 days is meant to lead us from the time of Daniel, you know, right around there, until the very end of time, it can't be 2300 literal days. It has to represent a longer period of time, 2300 years. Finally, in his articles, Dez also defends the idea of a pre-Advent or investigative judgment, though he doesn't explicitly connect it to 1844. Dez's position on Daniel 8 at this point seems to have been halfway between the traditional interpretation and where he will end up at and after Glacier View. Ford on Daniel proved to be the first popular version of this commentary on Daniel, which wouldn't be released for another 5 years. And of course, I'm talking about Black Daniel. If you have a copy of his Black Daniel Bible commentary, you know exactly why it's called that. It was later, it's been retitled and I think is being re-released as well. But to me, if you ask me, Black Daniel, that original commentary on Daniel will always remain the best designed Adventist book in our history. Although I shouldn't say that anymore, because Types and Symbols, what they've done with Ellen White's books is absolutely phenomenal. It's just really, really well done, and I'm sure you may be familiar with those. I'm not saying that thinking of Types and Symbols. I'm just thinking about all the other things that Pacific Press and the Review and whatnot have put out. Not to knock anybody, but Black Daniel is certainly the boldest design, in my opinion, of any Adventist book. The fact that the title is only in Hebrew, no English, it's just Daniel spelled in Hebrew. The big lion, the fact that it's black. I mean, there's no like nice white Jesus on the front of it to attract people. There's no scary beasts, you know, none of the usual stuff. Just a embossed or de-embossed lion on the cover. Daniel in Hebrew, Desmond Ford. Forward by F.F. Bruce. At the North New South Wales camp meeting in 1973, somebody circulated a paper describing Dez Ford and having received a new doctorate. He is now the Doctor of Doubt, which is like an Adventist version of a Bond villain, I guess. Anyways, the criticism had little impact. It was more scandalizing to folks there that somebody would refer to the head of the religion department at Avondale, thusly, you know, so it had little impact, but it was a sign of how Australian Adventism was increasingly polarizing throughout the 1970s between these so-called traditionalists and so-called progressives on the other side. And you think, what are the issues that they're polarizing over? Well, an easy way to tell where you are was based on how you answered this question. What is righteousness by faith? Thanks for listening. We'll talk again soon. Hey, it's me again. If this episode didn't quench your desire for more Adventist history content, then go subscribe to Avenus History Extra. It's a private podcast that I do for those who support the Avenus History Project. You can get access to Avenus History Extra on the website, which is avenushistoryproject.org, or by becoming a patron at patreon.com. Now, there's more variety at Avenus History Extra, in case you were wondering. I do some interviews. Sometimes I do bonus episodes. You know, we had a good episode here in the Avenus History Podcast, and I want to talk some more about it. Other times, I go behind the scenes at conferences I attend, like the Women in Seventh-day Adventist History Conference. What's more, just as a second announcement for you, Michael Campbell and I are leading a bus tour in October 2024. So, if you want to go drive around New England a bit, see the sights, and have some fun, well, you can sign up for our bus tour newsletter, once again, at AdventistHistoryProject.org. And we're going to keep you up to date there about what you need to know to go and sign up for that and all of that. So just to be very, 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 very clear, we don't have a sign up for the bus tour itself, but it's a sign up for the newsletter so you can stay informed about the bus tour so I don't have to make announcements every single time and interrupt these episodes and all of that. That's where those announcements are going to be. So if you're interested, head on over to the website. You can sign up for the bus tour newsletter over there. Okay, I think that about does it. Thanks again for listening.